the representative of the German High Command and government signed the act of unconditional surrender of all German land, sea and air forces in Europe.
The 8th of May 1945 was a day of rejoicing in Britain, the United States and many other countries. Germany had surrendered, and for Europe at least, World War II was over. Here in London, people celebrated with bunting, bonfires and street parties. Yet it was not a day of joy for everyone. For the vanquished Germans, May 1945 marked the end of bombings and of Nazi rule. But it was also a time of deprivation and chaos, fear and soul-searching. Millions of ethnic Germans from areas now in Poland and Russia had fled from the advancing Soviet forces, the Red Army. I'm Laura Wolfson, and this is The Documentary from the BBC World Service. I relate closely to the time we're talking about here. My own German father was 15 when the war ended. In a last-ditch effort of the regime, he was due to be sent to the front in February 1945. But he contracted a severe knee infection during a winter boot camp and was laid up for weeks. That infection probably saved his life. Over the next hour, I'll be hearing the stories of six people who lived through the end of the war in Germany. Ordinary people from different walks of life. Children and adults, men and women, a Nazi and a Jew. 80 years on, only one of the children, now over 90 years old, is still alive. All the other voices have fallen silent. I'll be bringing them to life through readings taken from their autobiographies, diaries and eyewitness accounts. With one exception, these have never been published in English before.
A boy with a soft, round, childish face held himself rigid when the officer I was with asked him if he was in pain. "Yes, but it doesn't matter. Germany must triumph."
Some said that all the carts would have to cross the frozen lagoon, but others disagreed. "If you try and cross that lagoon," one man shouted at us mockingly, "you'll all drown like rats."
The man who had destroyed Germany, the one who had annihilated the Jewish people, was no longer alive. But I, Hans Rosenthal, was alive, and healthy and free.
We'll be hearing what it was like for people to realize that the war was lost and how they began to face up to the fact that the country they loved had committed the most terrible crimes. Their accounts include some harrowing incidents which some listeners may find upsetting. We pick up the story in autumn 1944 at a Berlin allotment colony. Berliners used to grow vegetables and flowers on their allotments long before the war. Some also had small wooden garden houses where they might spend warm summer nights. After many of Berlin's homes had been destroyed by Allied bombings, some people were living there permanently. Among these was Frau Schönebeck. Her husband was a soldier on the Eastern Front. She had taken in a young man, 19 years old, Hans Rosenthal, known as Hansi. Hansi was Jewish. His parents had died, and his younger brother Geert had been deported to the East. His life depended on the safety of his hiding place in Frau Schönebeck's garden house and her scant food rations, which she shared with him.
One day, her son came back on leave. He stood in front of his mother and me, tall and healthy in his naval uniform. Frau Schönebeck told him who I was and why I was living with her. Her son was horrified. "If that comes to light, I'll be finished too," he said. "They'll make short work of it. No, you can't stay here. Please go." Frau Schönebeck cried. I was also fighting back the tears. Her son was right. But his mother pleaded for me, and she managed to change his mind. "All right," he said. "Stay then. But I don't know anything about it. I haven't seen you." He had been granted leave because he had been transferred to the submarines. When his leave ended, he disappeared forever. He never returned from a mission to the Arctic. Frau Schöneberg had saved me, but she had lost her own son.
Elsewhere in Berlin, schoolboys like my father and old men were being summoned to form what was known as the Volkssturm, Hitler's last-ditch militia that was meant to defend the German capital against the approaching Soviet forces. 27-year-old Milita Maschmann saw some of them after an Allied air raid.
In one suburb of Berlin, I saw a row of dead anti-aircraft auxiliaries lying side by side. The anti-aircraft base where these schoolboys were serving had received several direct hits. In another room lay the wounded. One of them, a boy with a soft, round, childish face, held himself rigid when the officer I was with asked him if he was in pain. "Yes, but it doesn't matter. Germany must triumph."
Such scenes did nothing to dampen Milita's enthusiasm for the Nazi cause. As a girl of 15, she had witnessed the torchlight parade the National Socialists had staged in Berlin after their election victory in 1933.
The crashing tread of the feet, the somber pomp of the red and black flags, the flickering light from the torches on the faces, and the songs with melodies that were at once aggressive and sentimental. For hours the columns marched by. I longed to hurl myself into this current, to be submerged and borne along by it. I was overcome by a burning desire to belong to these people. No catchword ever fascinated me quite as much as that of the national community, or Volksgemeinschaft. It acquired a magical glow. It was the hope that people of all classes would live together like brothers and sisters.
Against her parents' wishes, Milita joined the League of German Girls, the female arm of the Hitler Youth. After finishing school, she started to work in their press and propaganda office, a job that took her up and down the country, including to Nazi-occupied Poland. It was there that she first witnessed what was happening to the Jews under Nazi rule, when she chanced upon the Kutno Ghetto to the west of Warsaw, housed in the ruins of a sugar factory.
My path led me along a high-wire fence, in front of which an armed sentry patrolled. Behind the fence lay the ruined factory building. I looked into a burst tank. On the wall of the tank, a large cross had been painted in red paint, which had run down the wall like tears of blood. Was this tank the Jewish hospital? Many men, women, and children lay on the bare earth. The only exception were a few ragged children who stood close by the fence, with hands outstretched through the wire netting, begging. The wretchedness of these children brought a lump to my throat, but I clenched my teeth. "This is terrible," I said to myself. "But the driving out of the Jews is one of the unfortunate things we must bargain for if this is to become a German country."
In early 1945, parts of present-day Poland and Russia saw hundreds of thousands of ethnic Germans flee westwards from the approaching Red Army. Lore Erich, a war widow and mother of two, in her 30s, from a well-to-do, educated family, saw more and more of them passing through her hometown, then called Zensburg, in what was East Prussia.
The tranquility of our small town had been shattered. Day and night, the wheels of the horse-drawn wooden carts carrying refugees rolled westwards, cart after cart, in a never-ending line. These poorly equipped carts were a sad and deeply moving sight. The faces of children, wrapped up against the cold, peering out from them full of curiosity. The peasant women were staring straight ahead. Their faces beneath their dark woolen headscarves looked empty and hard.
Soon the German forces, the Wehrmacht, also began to withdraw westwards. Laura herself decided to flee with her elderly parents and her two small boys, Axel, 5 years old, and Olaf, who was two. The extreme cold and physical hardship of sitting on an open sleigh in temperatures below minus 20 degrees centigrade proved too much for Laura's father, a retired judge aged 74. She had to leave him and her mother behind in a village that was to be taken by the Red Army just days later. Laura and her children made it to a town then known as Braunsberg, near the huge Vistula Lagoon, which lies between that stretch of land and the Baltic Sea.
A lot of people were debating how best to move forward. Some said that all the carts would have to cross the frozen lagoon, but others disagreed. "If you try and cross that lagoon," one man shouted at us mockingly, "you'll all drown like rats!"
The lagoon was separated from the Baltic Sea by a narrow strip of land. The way across was between 7 and 15 kilometres long. German soldiers allocated Laura and her children to a farmer driving a two-horse cart.
We arrived at the lagoon and began our journey across it at dusk. In the first half hour, the foal that was walking next to the cart broke its leg and had to be left behind. Then, one of the two sturdy cart horses, Lisa, got her right front leg stuck in the ice, and it had to be laboriously freed with an axe. We had to keep considerable distances between each cart, and sometimes we'd stand still in the same place for hours. But the longer we stood still, the higher the water above the ice rose, and the prospect of falling through the ice and drowning became ever more likely. At daybreak, we saw the wreckage of carts that had crashed through the ice in many places. Some of the occupants had managed to escape and were continuing their journey on foot. So we moved on over the brittle ice in the direction of Karlberg, while low-flying planes buzzed over our heads and the Russians sent artillery greetings from the direction of Elbing.
Laura and her children did make it across the lagoon, but a long, difficult and dangerous journey still lay ahead. Eventually, they were taken to Nazi-occupied Denmark and put on a train heading north.
There was no milk for the babies, which meant that many of them died. Our train was horribly overcrowded, and we were all freezing cold. Olaf was sitting on my lap listlessly. His little face looked waxy, and his half-closed eyes kept rolling inwards. At times, I feared that he wouldn't survive the journey.
In the end, Laura and her children arrived at Hørby, a village almost at the northernmost tip of Denmark, where many of the refugee children died within a few short weeks. Laura's two boys survived. As March turned into April, it became clearer and clearer to many Germans that the war was lost. Elsewhere in German-occupied Europe, in Saint-Nazaire on the west coast of France, a 19-year-old German soldier, Georg Rosenberg, had access to a radio receiver, and he gave in to the temptation to do something extremely dangerous.
One day, while playfully twiddling the dial, I caught the German language Soldatensender Calais. I was easily able to tell from its reporting that this was a British propaganda station. After that, I tried to listen to it every day when I was alone, and as a result, I became well informed about what was really going on in the war. One morning in April 1945, I heard on one of those broadcasts that US President Roosevelt had died. I relayed this news innocently to the officers quartered in the neighbouring farmhouse. They were happy to hear it, as they were still hoping that Germany's fortunes in the war might turn. At noon that day, the door of my room opened. Six or seven officers headed by a colonel came in. "Turn on the radio," the colonel snapped at me. "We want to hear what station it was that spread that news." As I was to learn later, the Greater German Radio Network, controlled by the Nazis, did not report Roosevelt's death until their 1 p.m. bulletin. An icy shiver went through me. Only a few weeks earlier, like all German soldiers, I'd had to sign a decree which threatened every soldier with the death penalty and collective punishment of the family for crimes such as defeatism, desertion, and listening to enemy radio stations. "Turn it on!" the colonel barked at me. As soon as the first news reports came from the loudspeaker, he shouted at me. "Man, don't you realize that this is an enemy broadcast? You'll be hearing from me." Without another word, he and his subordinates walked out. I was left alone, shaking all over. I have never been more afraid in my entire life.
Around the same time, in the north of Denmark, Lore Erich began to realize that Germany's fate was sealed.
Most of the refugees were full of impotent rage against the government. Their only desperate wish was to find their relatives again, and to find them well. Apart from that, we were all aware that a terrible end lay ahead.
And Laura was beginning to wrestle with guilt and shame as she realized just how much calamity and horror Germany had inflicted upon the world.
How was I to pray now? As a good German, it surely wasn't right to pray for our downfall. Like any of my compatriots, I loved Germany and the place I'd called home. So, in the final years of the war, I often prayed like Abraham did for the doomed cities. "Lord, if there are only 50 righteous people here, don't let Germany perish." In the end, I no longer felt able even to pray like that. The catastrophe was inevitable.
Back in France, Georg, who'd been caught listening to the British propaganda network, was full of fear that his recklessness might cost him his life.
I knew what could happen. I could be charged with undermining military morale. A few months earlier, on my way to Saint-Nazaire, during a stopover in Paris, I had been assigned to a firing squad with 9 other cadets to execute a senior lance corporal of the German Wehrmacht. He had been sentenced to death for stealing a radio from a house which had been destroyed in an air raid on a French city. Evening came. Suddenly the door of my room opened. The entire group of officers entered. "It's over," I thought. "Everything's over." It was only with the greatest effort that I managed to stand to attention. "Turn it on," the colonel barked at me. My hands shook as I turned the dial. After a few bars of German military music, the news began. The colonel stood in front of me while his entourage sat down on chairs and on my camp bed. And then the miracle happened. They all listened to the entire news broadcast, silently, concentrating intently. I couldn't believe my luck. "Now," I thought, "now all of you who are listening have committed the same crime as I have." From that day on, they came every evening and listened to the news bulletins.
Back in Berlin, Hans Rosenthal, still stuck in his hiding place in the allotment colony, also had a small radio receiver. It enabled him to hear Nazi leaders like the Minister of Propaganda, Josef Goebbels, urging their people to keep fighting.
On the evening of April the 19th, the eve of Hitler's 56th birthday, Joseph Goebbels spoke again.
"Hinter ihnen geifert als ein Peitscher das internationale Judentum,
Once again, the armies of our enemies, the enemy powers, are attacking our defenses. International Jewry, which does not want peace until it has achieved its satanic goal of destroying the world, cracking the whip behind them. But it will be in vain. God will throw Lucifer back into the abyss from which he came. To me, it seemed like a ridiculous idea that God would want to take charge of destroying the enemy armies after Hitler had failed to do so. And international Jewry? Did that include me? Hans Rosenthal, now 20 years old, whose parents were dead and whose younger brother had been dragged away and disappeared without a trace?
Not far from Hansi's hideout, a 12-year-old boy was keen to play his part in the final defense of the German capital. Siegbert Stümpke was the son of a former government employee who'd been killed in action on the Eastern Front near Kyiv. Left alone with his mother, grandmother and two siblings, Siegbert was a keen observer of the battles that were raging around the city.
The command post for the defensive lines on the Teltow Canal was at the school at Marcus Square. I asked my mother, "What do you think? Should I go and ask at the school whether I can help in any way?" "Well, if that's what you want to do," was the answer.
He was turned down because of his age, but Siegbert was called back the very same day because the Wehrmacht officers saw an opportunity to make use of him.
"Come closer, my boy," the commander said. "I suppose you know the area well." "Yes, of course. There's hardly a corner here that I don't know." "That's excellent," he said. "We are having problems with our communications. We haven't heard anything from a Volkssturm unit on the canal since the attack. The connection to the anti-aircraft position on the railway bridge is also disrupted. Would you help us?" Of course I wanted to help. The commander handed me a messenger bag. "This is yours now," he said. "With this bag you are now the youngest runner in my unit. And if you see the Russians anywhere, come back immediately and let us know."
Join me again after the news to hear how this 12-year-old schoolboy fared on his dangerous mission. We'll also be finding out how Hans nearly lost his life when he ventured out to welcome the Soviet liberators of Berlin. And we'll be hearing how Milita dealt with her feelings of shame and guilt once the Nazi regime had collapsed. I'm Laura Wolfson, and this is The Documentary from the BBC World Service. Welcome back to The Documentary from the BBC World Service. I'm Laura Wolfson. In the next half hour, we'll be hearing what life was like in Germany after the country finally surrendered on the 8th of May, 1945, bringing World War II in Europe to an end. I'll continue to follow the stories of six ordinary Germans who lived through those days of fear and chaos, relief and soul-searching. You may find some of their accounts distressing. We'll be hearing what happened to Hans Rosenthal, the young Jew who'd survived the Holocaust in hiding and couldn't wait to go out and welcome the Soviet liberators of Berlin.
"They pointed their submachine guns at me. The way they were behaving left me in no doubt that they were going to stand me against the wall and shoot me."
And we'll be finding out how Melita Maschmann, the Nazi youth leader, eventually began to face up to her guilt. But first, back to the story of Siegbert Stümpke, the 12-year-old schoolboy from Berlin who'd been taken on by a local unit of the German Wehrmacht as a runner and couldn't wait to go out on his first mission.
"My grandma said, 'I'd much rather you stayed here.' But I was determined to do it. At 5:30, I was back at the school and was given two letters. One was for the anti-aircraft position, the other for a unit that was still holding a position on the other side of the canal against the Russians."
Using his bike, and then on foot, Siegbert made his way to the railway embankment where the anti-aircraft position was.
I crawled up on the embankment on all fours, taking care to maintain cover, quickly crossed the tracks and delivered my message. "Have the Russians arrived on the other side of the canal?" I asked one of the officers. "No, they don't like our guns," he said. A soldier handed me a reply letter. Then I went to the canal bridge and crossed the canal quickly. Once on the other side, I ran along the bottom of the embankment, maintaining cover, towards the sound of sporadic machine gun fire. Suddenly, quite close by, mortar fire. I pressed my body firmly to the ground and was suddenly really scared. I counted about 14 hits while my whole body was shaking. All of a sudden, it was quiet. At 8 p.m., I was already back at the school giving my report. A lieutenant said to me, "Boy, we're very happy with what you've done. Wait a moment." He disappeared into one of the rooms. When he came back out, he was holding 2 bars of chocolate and a long sausage. He handed them to me and said, "Go and get yourself home."
On the 21st of April, Soviet troops arrived at a small village called Zaka, located around 150 kilometers south of Berlin. Witnessing their arrival was an 11-year-old girl, Monika Koch.
The occupiers passed through the lower part of the village, where we lived. We watched anxiously from the window as the weary victors moved along the village road with their one-horse carts. Suddenly, 2 armed Russian soldiers approached our farm, greatly agitated, and shouting, "Partisan here!" They ran across the yard and through the barn to the field behind. Now it became clear what they were after. Sometime earlier, my brother-in-law had dug a hole in the field for my sister, who was 22 at the time. It was just deep enough for her to stand in and hide. The Russians must have seen her disappearing there from an elevation in the road. That's when Dora, a 19-year-old Ukrainian who'd been a forced labourer in Germany for 2 years, stepped in to help. She acted as an interpreter and saved the day. "So why a woman afraid?" asked the soldiers. In this case, all had turned out well.
Back in Berlin, Siegbert Stümpke and his family were beginning to realise that they might be in trouble if Soviet soldiers found them in possession of any Nazi paraphernalia.
Before he became a soldier, my father used to work in the Reich Chancellery. For his birthday, on April the 20th, Hitler always received lots of gifts that he didn't like. The employees were told to take those home, and so we had things that we didn't like either, but we couldn't very well throw them out for obvious reasons. For example, we had a painting showing the North Sea. In the middle of the picture, the artist had painted an eye. That probably meant that the Führer was watching the country and its people. We also had a large tapestry made from coconut fibre. It was red and had a swastika on it. We didn't have a wall space large enough to hang it on, so we used it as a carpet. Grandma and I dragged the carpet, the picture, and everything else we might be able to burn into the basement boiler room. It was really difficult pushing the huge tapestry through the door of the furnace. When I looked later, I was horrified to see that everything had turned to ash, except for the coconut fiber tapestry. "What are we going to do with it?" asked Grandma. "We'll bury it in the bomb crater behind the yard," I suggested. So that's what I did.
With the Soviet forces now in Berlin, Hans Rosenthal was eager to venture out of his allotment hideout, despite the worries of his protector. He put on his yellow star, the Nazi-enforced mark of his Jewishness, to show the liberators that he was welcoming them.
At the waterworks, I was surrounded by Russians. They pointed their submachine guns at me. I pointed at my star and smiled, even though my heart was pounding like mad. The way they were behaving left me in no doubt that they were going to stand me against the wall and shoot me. I stood there with my hands raised, completely confused. An officer passed by on a bicycle. He stopped, dismounted, and walked through the soldiers towards me. The officer was Jewish. What a relief. He asked me in Yiddish if I was also Jewish. Yes, I said. I'm Jewish, not an SS man. I was in hiding. I was stammering with fear, because from among those surrounding me, I'd heard something that sounded like SS. The officer was still suspicious. He asked me to recite our creed in Hebrew. I recited it, and somehow I understood the meaning for the first time. Shema Yisrael Adonai Eloheinu Adonai Echad. Hear, O Israel, the Eternal One is our God. The Eternal God is one. The officer seemed moved. You are Jewish, he said at last. You can go. But take off the star, he added. Why? I asked. You've been lucky, said my rescuer. This division liberated the Majdanek concentration camp. Some SS guards there took the yellow stars off the prisoners' clothes and pinned them onto their own. When we discovered this, there was an order. Anyone found with such a star was to be shot at once.
Some of the real SS, Hitler's feared elite unit, were still at large and determined to fight the Allied occupation. At the end of April, Milita Maschmann was hired as a cook and housekeeper by a group of them, who were hiding out in a remote mountain valley in Austria.
The men had already had experience of dangerous sabotage operations. Several of them told how they had been dropped behind the Russian lines, dressed as American paratroopers, to work as military agents. On some evenings, we suddenly felt a yearning for intellectual satisfaction. Sometimes the men persuaded me to read from the two books I carried in my pack. The situation was romantic. Down below in the valley burned the watchfires which the Americans maintained on hidden landmarks, while up above we sat wrapped in fur coats, listening to the poems of Hölderlin by the light of a candle.
Doch du, mein Vaterland, du heilig Duldendes, siehe, du bist geblieben.
I have often asked myself since then, what kind of men were they with whom you spent those weeks? What was their past? These questions forced themselves upon me when I learned about the part played by the SS in the extermination of the Jews.
Aus dem Führerhauptquartier wird gemeldet, dass unser Führer Adolf Hitler...
On the 30th of April 1945, Adolf Hitler, known as the Führer, took his own life in his underground bunker in Berlin. News of his death reached the public over the days that followed, couched in heroic and blatantly false terms by the new Nazi leadership.
When I returned to Frau Schönebeck's summer house around midnight on May the 1st, there was great excitement. Hitler is dead. I was silent. Then I just said, at last. The man who had destroyed Germany, who was responsible for the deaths of millions of people from so many nations, the one who had annihilated the Jewish people, was no longer alive. But I, Hans Rosenthal, was alive, and healthy, and free. Of course, I thought of my younger brother that day. I didn't hold out much hope that he would still be alive.
Milita Maschmann, in her mountain hideout in Austria, didn't find out about the death of her adored Führer until more than a week later, when she came across a radio during a visit to a farmhouse situated near a steep rock face.
I expected the wall of rock to rear up and plunge into the valley below. Hitler was dead. With a feeling of inner emptiness that made me feel giddy, I climbed back up to the men. When I opened the door of the hut, the candle on the table went out. Then I said in the darkness, Hitler is dead. He's died by suicide in his bunker in Berlin. I heard the men leap to their feet. That night they got drunk almost without speaking a word. Meanwhile, I lay as if stunned in my corner. I could not even weep.
The end of the war in Europe was officially announced by Mr. Churchill at 3 o'clock this afternoon in a broadcast from 10 Downing.
The news brought me a great sense of happiness. The surrender meant that God had not allowed himself to be mocked. All we knew about Germany itself was that it had ceased to exist, and no one had any idea whether they would live under Russian, Polish, British, American, or French rule in the future.
Back in Berlin, just weeks after the end of the war, Hans Rosenthal took the first steps towards finally building a life for himself. His dream was to work in broadcasting. So he made his way to the broadcasting house in the western part of Berlin, a building then held by the Soviets.
As I stepped into the entrance portal, a Soviet soldier stood in the way. He was armed and looked at me disdainfully. "What do you want?" he asked. "Robotier, robotier," I replied. We had quickly learned that word. It meant work. The Soviets were demanding a lot of robotier from the defeated Germans. The soldier reacted accordingly. He let me through. I walked through the corridors of the radio station in a daze. So this was where it had all happened. Goebbels had given his radio speeches here. The Führer had sat in front of the microphone here while reading out appeals to his people. I was, in a sense, in the birthplace of Nazi power. Everything I had listened to on my little radio, with the exception of the BBC broadcasts, of course, had come from here.
Elsewhere in Germany, the vanquished Germans had far more traumatic encounters with some of the victorious Allied forces. Among them, the family of 11-year-old Monika, who had fled their village after the Germans retook it from the Soviets.
We stopped at De Polderswalde. Together with around 15 other people, we were allowed to sleep in the straw in a farmer's barn. We felt like we were in no man's land, waiting for the Americans. Until one night, two Russian soldiers suddenly stood in the barn and searched the row of sleeping people with a torch. The first one they took was the little 17-year-old Hungarian girl, and then our neighbour, who was lying next to me. They took turns, with the other Russian keeping everyone else at bay with his submachine gun. At least he had turned off his torch. I was just 11 and literally crawled on top of my mother. I didn't want them to take her. Please, not my mum. That night was never spoken of again. The shame was too great.
While most people were living through a mixture of chaos, trauma, and hope in the early weeks after the war, one woman was in a strange, almost idyllic bubble of her own. Milita Maschmann, the Nazi youth leader. She'd left her SS hideout and had nowhere to go, as both her parents had been killed in an air raid in 1944. Aware that she was likely to be arrested soon, she enjoyed an early summer of rambling around the Austrian countryside.
I was lying under a bush, which was filled with humming bees, watching children at play on the edge of a village. They were throwing a turnip to one another like a ball and shaking with laughter. Suddenly, a window in the house behind them opened, and I heard, faintly at first and then more clearly, the great Richakar from the musical Offering. As I absorbed the music, along with the scent of the flowering bush and the children's laughter, I felt as if I had awoken from an evil enchantment.
In the second half of June, it finally began to feel like summer. When I opened the window, I was greeted by the scent of clover and jasmine, The children were playing in the sand, and people recovering from diseases or injuries were lying in the tall grass sunbathing. The laundry was fluttering in the light summer breeze, and I could hear larks singing in the fields.
In July 1945, Melita Mashman was arrested and interrogated by the American forces.
The first day was the worst of my imprisonment. For the first time, I faced the truth. The Third Reich, to which millions of Germans had sacrificed their lives, their health and their property, had burst, like a soap bubble. From the morning until late into the night, I lay on the floor of my cell and wept until I had no more tears left.
Back in the village of Zaka, where the family of 11-year-old Monika had eventually returned, life remained traumatic for several more months.
The attacks, looting and rapes continued for a long time, well into the autumn. At home, whistles and pot lids were placed everywhere so that people could warn each other or call for help if an attack was imminent. No child and no old woman was safe anymore. My 9-year-old cousin and her 70-year-old grandmother had taken the risk of going into the nearby woods to pick blueberries. They were found dead 3 days later, covered with sticks. They had been raped and murdered.
Like many Germans who had lived through traumatic events, Monika Korch returned to a semblance of normality very soon. She went back to school and later trained as a secretary. Lore Erich was to stay in Denmark until 1947, and she and her children would live in a succession of camps until 1956. But she was eventually reunited with her mother. Georg Rosenberg, the young soldier who'd taken part in an execution and listened to enemy broadcasts, returned home, worked in civil aviation, and lived to the age of 97. Siegbert Stümpke, the 12-year-old who was used as a runner by the German Wehrmacht, grew up to become a glassmaker and later a dolphin trainer. And Hans Rosenthal, who was so keen to work in broadcasting,
ich muss vielleicht noch nachtragen. Herr Stein sprang eben hoch, beinahe wäre das ganze Mikrofon umgekippt vor Freude.
Hansi, or Hänschen, as he was affectionately known, was to become one of Germany's most popular TV and radio quiz show hosts of the 1970s and 80s. Here he is with one of his signature radio shows.
Es gewann mit 5-0 Reinhard Stein. Wir gratulieren.
But Hans never saw his younger brother again. Gerd Rosenthal, who'd been deported to the East by the Nazis at just 10 years of age, was killed in the Holocaust, along with many of Hans's wider family. Which leaves Melita Mashman. She was kept in detention until 1948. During the process known as denazification carried out by the Allies, she was initially classed as a major offender, which could have meant a long prison sentence or even death. But later she found herself reclassified as a follower, considered too young to be fully responsible for her actions, a decision which, at the time, she felt was shameful. But how did she deal with the knowledge that she had supported a regime that had killed 6 million Jews and plunged much of Europe into unprecedented death and destruction?
It may surprise and horrify you that it took me a good dozen years to complete my inner break with National Socialism. For years after the end of the war, I derived a feeling of self-righteousness from the knowledge that I had become a National Socialist because I wanted to help the socially underprivileged members of our nation. That is, from an impulse of love. Only in 1950 or 1951 did I suddenly grasp how narrow this love had been. What good a kindness, self-sacrifice,
energy and a sense of responsibility, if they are so jealously guarded that only one's brothers and sisters may benefit from them.
The starkest expression of what Melita calls her narrow love had been her anti-Semitism.
Anti-Semitism had been second nature to me since childhood. Now, I began to believe that it was wrong, but I was in danger of building up a fresh hatred of the people we had wronged just because of my growing feelings of guilt.
The breakthrough for Melita came through a meeting with a Jewish survivor of the Holocaust.
She knew about my political past, which made me all the more uneasy. I will never forget the glow of spontaneous kindness in this woman's eyes when she first held out her hand to me. It bridged all gulfs without denying them. At that moment, I jumped free from the devil's wheel. I was no longer in danger of converting feelings of guilt into fresh hatred. The forgiving love which I had encountered gave me the strength to accept our guilt and my own. Only then did I cease to be a National Socialist. I am tempted to invoke the Christian concept of grace when I think of what happened to me then. A stranger offered me her hand with a smile, and in that instant I knew that I shared the guilt for her parents' death, and not only for that. When I stood before the ghettos in Łódź and Kutno, I was not too young, but too hard-hearted, too cowardly, and too flattered by the role of leader which I played in the Third Reich, to admit that with my whole being, I was helping to commit a crime unworthy of mankind.
Melita spent many years wrestling with the questions thrown up by her Nazi past. In her autobiography, published in 1963, she tries to analyze how her younger self could have been swept up by fascism, and she concludes that no one is immune.
We can no longer distinguish neatly between those who are evil and those who are good. What I learned about myself, and what we all should learn, is that the frontier between good and evil can run straight through the middle of us, without our being aware of this. None of us should feel immune from the possibility of one day too becoming the blind and cold-hearted servant of evil.
Today, at a time when war and aggression are once again causing deep divisions and enormous suffering in different parts of the world, Melita's words seem like a warning for every one of us, anywhere in the world. Melita's account was criticized by some as a brazen attempt to justify herself, yet she had the courage to face her past publicly and with honesty in the early 1960s, at a time when few of her compatriots and mine were ready to do so. In my father's case, his shame about having believed Nazi propaganda as a child resulted in him judging himself and others very harshly throughout his life. This had a profound impact on our family, as similar personal histories did on countless others. You've been listening to Defeated with me, Laura Wolfson, from the BBC World Service. The readers, in order of appearance, were Isaac Grin, Stephanie Lane, Mandy Weston, Charlie Russell, Joshua Linden, and Lex Parry. The documentary was produced by Christina Pommert, with research by Katie Harris, and it was a CTVC production.